headlines. The UN calls for $4.3 billion in aid to Yemen this year to help millions of people affected by years of Saudi war and blockade. Egypt's foreign minister travels to Syria, the first such visit in over a decade, one day after several senior Arab lawmakers went to Damascus. And a senior Russian official warns that the continued flow of Western weapons to Ukraine could spell a global nuclear catastrophe. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Ahead of a UN-led donor conference on Yemen in Geneva, the world body has called for $4.3 billion in aid to the war-torn country in 2023. The UN says aid agencies require the money to help over 17 million Yemenis. The organization says the country is at the forefront of the climate crisis, with severe drought and flooding threatening lives. Meanwhile, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said the international community has the power and the means to end the crisis in Yemen. Millions of Yemenis have been on the brink of famine and medical crises due to a Saudi-led blockade since 2015. The UN estimates that two-thirds of Yemen's population will require humanitarian aid and protection services in the year 2023. Egypt's foreign minister is in Damascus on a first visit by the country's top diplomat to Syria in over a decade. Samih Shoukry has held talks with the Syrian foreign minister Faisal Baghdad and President Bashar al-Assad. Egypt's foreign ministry has described the visit as a message of solidarity with Damascus in the face of the consequences of the earthquake of February 6. Several Arab countries that cut ties with Syria during the country's war have used the quake for a thaw with Damascus. A number of Arab parliament speakers and lawmakers also traveled to the Syrian capital during the weekend. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev warns that the continued flow of weapons to Ukraine could spell a global nuclear catastrophe. Medvedev, who is the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, said supplying Kiev with more arms would diminish the prospect of resolving the Ukraine conflict through dialogue. He said Moscow's enemies dismissed the fact that the goals would definitely result in what he called an apocalypse. Last week, the Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a similar warning about the threats of a nuclear disaster. Putin compared the ongoing war with Ukraine to an existential battle for the survival of Russia. Moscow has repeatedly sounded the alarm that the Western military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war with Ukraine. The French President Emmanuel Macron is set to visit Africa this week as Paris attempts to restore its influence following a series of military and political setbacks. Macron's four-nation tour will take him to Gabon, Angola, Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The president is set to deliver a speech on his strategy to deepen the partnership with African countries ahead of his trip later Monday. This comes as anti-France sentiment is running high in some of France's former colonies in Africa. Last week, France withdrew its forces from Burkina Faso after its government ended an accord that allowed French military presence. Mali has also ended its military cooperation with France after 10 years, giving its place to Russian military contractors. A migrant shipwreck in waters south of Italy has killed 58 people, including several children. This is the latest in a series of migrant tragedies in Europe that have claimed thousands of lives. Stay with us for a deeper look at the incident in our News Review program.
Time now for the News Review. The death toll from a migrant shipwreck near the coast of southern Italy has risen to 58. Several children are also among the victims. Italian Coast Guard saying that around 80 migrants have survived the tragic incident. The vessel crashed against rocks during rough sea weather. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says that she is deeply saddened by the tragedy. She called for progress and installed reform of EU asylum rules. Italy is one of the main landing points for migrants trying to enter Europe by sea. More than 20,000 people have reportedly died or gone missing in the central Mediterranean since 2014. Let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have Max Civili, our correspondent in Rome. John Stepling, author and commentator, is also joining me from Indre in Norway. Now, Max, beginning with you, you said that rights activists in your reports and also other correspondence reports, they're mostly blaming Prime Minister Meloni for this, but she doesn't seem to be blaming herself for this, does she?
Well, since day one of her mandate, Giorgia Meloni has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what she calls irregular migration. Basically, the Meloni government has been accusing, since day one, charity ships of acting as a pull factor and encouraging people traffickers. And in order, the government said that to counter this trend, the Meloni government introduced a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships operating in the Mediterranean Sea and rescuing asylum seekers. This happened in November last year. Basically, these new measures force all NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately, without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. And this, of course, prevents NGO ships from saving other migrants. This is what at least an Italian court said, and what the Council of Europe said a few weeks ago. The Council of Europe has urged Italy to scrap that decree, that provision, describing it as a breach of international law. This is why some humanitarian groups blame Prime Minister Meloni.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, John, it's not only Italy, it's other European countries as well. But in terms of Ursula von der Leyen saying that she's deeply saddened by this tragedy, I mean, is this really true? Is this not duplicity? Because maybe it's blue-eyed human rights, huh? Because when the Ukrainians, spread out in Europe, they were embraced warmly. But when people from other countries, find their way, they take you to rough seas and they endanger their lives, this is the response that they're getting.
If we step back just a little bit, this is the history of capitalism. The Western world has exploited the non-Western world for 150 years through colonialism, colonial settlers, occupation, and it was racialized. Racial tiers were created to justify the slave trade. And this has not changed. And the U.S. is the great imperial power. These people are fleeing intolerable conditions, war zones. And as you say, Ukrainians are relatively welcomed when they enter Europe from a war zone. But black Africans or Muslims or South Asians or Latin Americans are not welcome in the Western world. Biden just passed a law that will stop all migration across the southern border of the U.S. No asylum applications will be accepted. It's a law that is actually worse than the one Trump put in place. So, but this is not a new story. I mean, this is, as I say, gone on for 150 years. The U.S. has business interests in Africa. It has military bases in all but one country in Africa. Those bases and soldiers are there to protect Western business interests, whether it's mining or whatever it is. And this has been a story that has gone on with genocidal, implications at times, whether it's Tanzania, Australia, parts of Africa, German South Africa, Latin America, Central America, all the way back to the United Fruit Company in Central America. I mean, this is nothing new.
Okay, appreciate your comments and contribution. Max Civelli in Italy, John Steppeling in Norway.
Iran says it supports China's plan to end the war in Ukraine, calling for genuine diplomacy to resolve the conflict. Iran's foreign ministry says the proposal put forth by Beijing can pave the way for a mutually agreed framework to settle the conflict. It also denounced the West's unilateral measures, saying it is time to put an end to actions that only fuel the flames of war. The ministry also rejected what it called the Cold War era's hegemonic mentality and blamed the U.S.-led NATO for being behind many global crises, including the Ukraine war. Taiwan has also expressed its readiness to contribute to a peaceful settlement of the conflict. On Friday, China called for a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine in a 12-point position paper it released on the political settlement of the crisis. Political commentator Digby James Wren says China is the only country that can play a mediator role in the Ukraine conflict.
China has shown since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan that China has been the mediator. It's put itself in the position as mediator for a large number of arrangements, specifically across Asia inside the SCO, for example. The SCO exists for that, and they have a lot of experience doing this. And the second thing to understand about the position paper that's been released is, in the Chinese way, it's conceptual. It lays out the principles and the basic concepts that would be required to move forward to develop a framework. It's not in itself a detailed framework, and it's not supposed to be. What it's supposed to do is be sufficiently inclusive and have all of the important topics that need to be discussed so that the other partners, and I suppose the P5 plus some others, and we can see that, for example, that the French president is going to China very soon. Olaf Scholz was just in India. The Iranian president was just in China. And so intense diplomacy is already happening. And so this just gives it a sort of a general umbrella, if you like, to operate within. And then the way to do it is to work down to details. So, look, this 12-point plan is the ideal starting point. It's quite loose. It gives lots of space for lots of people to give some detail, and that's the idea. And questioning the sincerity of it is just a way of discrediting the Chinese, and I think that's not useful.
Israeli settlers have killed a Palestinian man near the West Bank city of Nablus amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. Samah Tash, 37, was killed after he was shot with a live bullet during an assault by Israeli settlers and forces south of Nablus. Around 400 Palestinians were also injured after troops and settlers raided parts of the city. They blocked the streets, pelted stones, and set fire to several Palestinian homes and vehicles. The raid followed the killing of two Israelis in a West Bank settlement earlier in the day. The regime has intensified its deadly crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories since the formation of a far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. 66 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank this year so far. Palestinian Authority and Israeli officials have held talks in Jordan amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. The talks in the Red Sea port of Aqaba also included officials from the U.S. as well as Egypt. At the end of the meeting, Israeli and Palestinian Authority officials stressed the need for de-escalation on the ground. They also agreed to meet again in Egypt next month. Resistance groups, including Hamas, had called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the meeting. They say that it's a U.S. plot against Palestinian aspirations.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba security summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate.
and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Iran wants a strong Iraq, quite in contrast to what the U.S. and Israel seek in Iraq, which is instability. IRGC Chief Major General Hossein Salami says foreign powers want Iraq partitioned, scenario unfavorable to Iran and Muslim countries. The general made the remarks during a meeting with the visiting Iraqi Defense Minister, Thabit Mohammad Said al-Abbasi. Iraqi officials said his country is looking forward to expanding military cooperation with Iran. It was a response to the IRGC chief's offer of military training for Iraqi security forces. Iran actively helped Iraq fight off Daesh terrorists. The two countries now seek to sign a security cooperation agreement with an eye on border security. In Peru, protests sparked by the removal of President Pedro Castillo continue after nearly 3 months. A new poll finds that most Peruvians believe that what took place was a coup carried out by Congress against the elected president. Camila Escalante reports from the Peruvian town of Desaguadero.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe this strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله. بسم الله.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on January 4th, 2023. I've repeated this on numerous occasions during the Eid al-Fitr prayers in the Eid al-Fitr sermon or in the ceremonies that are held in the month of Ramadan, and there were women who were covered in different ways in these ceremonies and were shedding tears. I envy them for shedding tears like that. I tell myself that I wish I could shed tears like that girl or that young woman. How can you make accusations against such a person? Yes, not observing the hijab properly or having inadequate form of hijab is not the right thing to do, but this does not mean that we should exclude these individuals from religion and the revolution and consider them to be outsiders. Why should we do such a thing? We all have certain flaws that we need to correct. The more flaws we correct, the better. This was another issue that had to do with the subject of hijab. One issue that I don't have time to talk about, unfortunately, is the service that the Islamic Republic has provided to women. This should not be forgotten.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. nations should be united.
I don't think any of you have seen the period before the revolution. I have spent almost half of my life in the period before the revolution. In the pre-revolution period, there were very few women who were wise, intelligent, educated scholars, researchers and experts in various fields. There are all these female university professors, all these female specialists and consultants in the medical sciences, and all these research scientists in different departments. When I say different departments, there are places that I have actually visited and seen for myself. Intelligent female scientists are working in advanced scientific and technological areas. Such a thing did not exist before the revolution. This is an outcome of the revolution. We have all these female university students. In some years, the statistics have shown that there were more female students than male students. There is much meaning in this. There is all this intense desire to study and gain knowledge.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Another missile test by North Korea. 4 long-range cruise missiles. This particular test, however, was different. Even North Korea's media reported it that way. Strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word, counterattack. North Korea has been very clear about its missile tests, and there's nothing new there. It has been in response to the U.S. joint war games in the region, whether with South Korea or Japan. However, now it has described the weapons as strategic, suggesting that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The scenario of North Korea's missile launches and the types of ballistic missiles came into full gear in the year 2022, during the U.S. presidency of Joe Biden. North Korea fired more than 70 ballistic missiles, the most ever. But why would these launches increase so much during Joe Biden's tenure? One reason: the U.S. lack of a foreign policy approach towards North Korea. Just war games and condemnations. The U.S. has even flown B-52 bombers in its war games. High-ranking U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham once said, quote, "If there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there. If thousands die, they're going to die over there." Sanctions have been exhausted. Yet what has been missing is diplomacy or some kind of peace process. But the U.S. has no appetite for that. The U.S. track record shows that it chooses military solutions to foreign policy problems. But why, when in the case of North Korea, given that it has intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. mainland? In the past, the U.S. has used the preventive approach. The U.S. has in its attack doctrine preventive strikes, which differ from preemptive strikes in that they would not be a response to imminent attack from an enemy. Preventive military action has become a popular option among U.S. officials, culminating with George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. But there's a more important reason. The U.S. may simply use this approach towards North Korea in order to make it give concessions. That, along with the U.S.'s long-sought prize, China. The U.S.'s coming war with China is now perceived as not a matter of if, but when. The telltale signs are there. From the U.S. National Security Reports, which cite China as the number one threat to U.S. national security, to arming allies in the region, like Japan, the Philippines, and Taiwan. For example, Tokyo just recently announced a record 26.3% increase in its defense spending, which will include missiles capable of reaching China. And then there is Taiwan, which aside from arming it to the tune of billions of dollars, the U.S. will be sending more troops to the island. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, possible showdown with Russia, its military threats against Iran, and its potential conflict with North Korea and China. Open Society Foundations described it best when it said, America is in a constant state of war, and its founding values are approaching annihilation.
Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African-American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. The iconic leader was born in 1925 and was jailed for robbery in 1946. In prison, he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and became influenced by the teachings of his leader. He was assassinated at the age of 39 on the 21st of February 1965 by three men. Now, after 58 years, his daughter says federal agencies concealed evidence of his murder and she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police and others for his death. Eliza Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agency conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you.
The slaying of the black leader has been the subject of speculation about the potential involvement of secret government agencies in his assassination. Back then, the FBI infiltrated black rights movements in a bid to dismantle them. Malcolm X was a lead spokesman for the Nation of Islam. The group advocated separatism for black Americans. Malcolm X later split from the organization and toned down some of his radical views. In the 1950s, the United States reckoned with its prevalent racism, and Malcolm X's assassination was a turning point back then. The civil rights movement, which was a campaign to abolish racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement throughout the United States, culminated in the 1960s. Various individuals and groups, most notably Martin Luther King, struggled to rid the United States of its institutional racism. But despite years of struggle and some success, structural racism is still rampant in the U.S.
It has failed, and it's very tragic. There's been so much suffering. You know, even when there is progress in the 1960s during what's often referred to as the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, there were gains made, but at the same time that there were legislative remedies made, immediately we see the mass incarceration system beginning, and we see neoliberalism taking hold, which impoverished so many millions of people.
The median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people. And black people are also less likely to benefit from home ownership, the engine of generational wealth in America. Black couples are also more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to be denied a mortgage or a home improvement loan. Furthermore, only about 5.7% of physicians in the U.S. identify as black or African American. This statistic does not reflect the communities they serve, as an estimated 12% of the U.S. population is black or African American. One reason for this disproportionate number is that black people have been historically excluded from medicine, and life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans. A black child born today is likely to live up to 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby.
So with if there is not a commitment at the top, if there's not seriousness about acknowledging racism and its impact, then we end up with the situation where we're in now, where the U.S. continually claims to be this racism-free country, when in fact it is anything but.
In a State of the Nation address in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Putin accused the U.S.-led NATO alliance of fanning the flames of the conflict in the mistaken belief that it could defeat Moscow in a global confrontation. He blamed the West for starting the conflict in Ukraine, saying Western countries led by the United States were seeking unlimited power in world affairs. The Russian president said Moscow was not fighting the people of Ukraine, stressing that Ukraine has become a hostage of the Kyiv regime and its Western masters, which have effectively occupied the country. He also accused the U.S.-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kyiv with arms and munitions. Putin warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. In an important announcement, Putin said Russia was suspending participation in a major arms control agreement with the U.S.
I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty but suspends its participation in it.
The New START treaty was signed in Prague in 2010. It came into force the following year and was extended in 2021 for 5 more years after United States President Joe Biden took office. It caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that the U.S. and Russia can deploy and deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver them. Together, Russia and the U.S. hold about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin also hailed the resistance of the Russian economy in the face of massive sanctions by the West.
As I already mentioned, the West is launching not just a military and informational war against us, but has also opened an economic front. But it is achieving nothing nowhere and will not achieve anything.
He added that the Russian economy has managed to do well despite Western countries' predictions of its collapse. Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual speech coincided U.S. President Joe Biden's unannounced trip to Ukraine and Poland. Biden stepped up his anti-Russia rhetoric during his trip. He pledged more arms for Kyiv and a fresh round of sanctions against Russia during a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden proclaimed unwavering support for Kyiv and a commitment to bolstering NATO's eastern flank facing Russia. Biden's trip has also drawn criticism from inside America.
America. Conservative Republicans have censured his decision to travel to an active war zone without a significant American military presence. They argue that instead Biden should have visited the border with Mexico or the Ohio town stricken by toxic waste spilled from a derailed train. Kevin Hearn, a House Republican from Oklahoma, who chairs the influential Republican Study Committee, said the president's now spent more time in Kyiv than he has at our southern border. House Republican David Kostoff said there are a lot of people here in the U.S. that would say he probably should have gone to Ohio and visited with the people who have been afflicted by the derailment first. Also, the right-wing American lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene said Biden chose Ukraine over America, while forcing the American people to pay for Ukraine's government and war. I cannot express how much Americans hate Joe Biden. The comments from Republicans were in many ways business as usual for the Biden presidency. The GOP has hammered him since practically the start of his administration for the increase in migrant arrivals on the southern border and more recently seized on the East Palestine derailment to argue his administration is turning a blind eye to an environmental disaster. East Palestine's mayor, Trent Conaway, said that Biden's Ukraine trip was the biggest slap in the face. That tells you right now he doesn't care about people. Last month, Biden visited Texas's border with Mexico shortly after he announced new restrictions on migrants who arrive in the United States, which drew opposition from advocacy groups and progressive Democrats. But the comments from the Republican lawmakers could also be harbingers of major political battles to come. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has supplied Kyiv with about $30 billion worth of weaponry and other aid, but the country has asked for more. That will require the agreement of both the Biden administration and his Democratic allies controlling the Senate, as well as the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives. A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Despite calls for dialogue and a peaceful solution to end the conflict, Western nations, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine, including heavy military equipment. This trend has only escalated the conflict, and prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Also, it seems that Ukraine's allies are gearing up for a much longer war. In his first trip to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict, U.S. President Joe Biden met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. During his hours-long surprise visit to Kyiv, Biden said he was there to show his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
And I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. And today, I hope we're going to have a chance to discuss how the United States and our allies, by keeping constant contact with them, our partners, can most effectively support you and your cause, Mr. President.
And later, at a joint presser with Zelensky, Biden promised increased arms deliveries to Ukraine.
We've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all defend Ukraine. And that doesn't count the other $500 million we're announcing with you today and tomorrow.
Zelensky hailed the visit as a key sign of support, saying Russia does not stand a chance of winning the war.
Пане президенте, я знаю, що...
This is an unequivocal signal that Russian attempts to win will have no chance. Together, we will protect our cities and our people from the terror of Russia.
While Biden was in Kyiv, the U.S. State Department announced a further $460 million in aid to Ukraine. The assistance includes $450 million in artillery ammunition, anti-armor systems, and air radars, as well as $10 million for energy infrastructure. Biden's visit to Ukraine was the first trip to the country by a U.S. president in 15 years. The visit came 4 days before the first anniversary of the breakout of the war between Ukraine and Russia.
Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kyiv with weapons, saying it would only prolong the conflict. Now, Biden's trip has clearly sent a contradictory message to Moscow. That is, the influx of weapons to Ukraine will continue and that Washington exactly wants the war to go on. Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Western countries, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending arms to the country rather than supporting dialogue. Now, the US has accused China of planning to send weapons to Russia in its war with Ukraine, warning Beijing that any supplies would cause a serious problem.
We have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state. We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Blinken said he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The warning comes as the US has been the largest provider of weapons to Ukraine during the year-long war with Russia. In reaction to Blinken's comments, China rejected the accusation, saying it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield.
It is the US, not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the US pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even cursing us.
China has expressed deep concern over the Ukraine conflict getting out of control. Beijing has also urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire while pledging to promote dialogue to resolve the conflict.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadorbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar. Baytullah al-Haram, the house of Allah in Mecca, is the first house erected for people. Simplicity of the house and the mosque, as in time of the Prophet Abraham and early days of Islam, and the congregation of Muslims in that unpolluted place is 1,000 times greater than decoration of the Kaaba and tall buildings, while being negligent of the main purpose, which is rising for people and securing the interests of people.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to IRB English Radio and this program, Spring of the Truth, in which we are trying to have a look at some of the statements and viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, specifically in this series of shows about the Islamic government and Islamic country. Imam rahmatullah alayh says in one of his statements that we did not want a literal Islamic republic. We wanted God's rule to be implemented in our country and, God willing, in other countries as well. So Imam here says that whatever we are talking about is not something that is going to stay at the level of a literal level. No, we are looking for actual manifestation of Islamic Republic to flourish in different aspects and dimensions of lives of the people. As we said earlier, everything should be based on the divine rulings, the rulings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we have to think that absolute power belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Actual materialization of that desired government is not going to happen by words and by sayings. Imam rahmatullah alayhi says that we wish the same thing to happen in our country and other countries, in other Muslim countries, so that they taste the beauty of Islamic management in their own countries. Actually, all the Muslims yet are in the wish of having such a desired Islamic model, in which this beautiful model is going to materialize. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. صلى الله عليه يا رسول الله يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله. So Imam is looking at all the characteristics of an Islamic government that we have referred to in our previous sessions. That Imam wants all of those elements to manifest themselves and to show the effects to the Muslims and to the people in a country in which there is no domination and arrogance of the leaders and the statesmen to people, and the viewpoints and the ideas of the people are valued and respected. The kind of important that is given to the rulership of Allah's laws and rulings on the scene of the earth is again important. So all these beautiful criteria that we are in search of, and more specifically the spread of justice in different dimensions and aspects of such a government and country, is something which can be desired by everyone, any freedom seeker, any wise in the whole world, in the wish and in the search of such a government. And Imam rahmatullah alayhi wants us to reach to that point.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and day.
every night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community and most importantly, the people. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's economy and the Kashmir situation. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE free trade pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out, which seem to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations, which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French, and for that matter, Israel and the Economic Union, which have, of course, had over 500 years of dominance to get things right and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change. And the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, They're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national.